Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the news extra edition for the week ending Saturday, the 1st of August 2020. My name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. I hope you'll forgive my slightly croaky voice, I'm sure it'll be better next time. So, in this programme we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current editions of the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We also have our selection of national radio highlights coming up in the next week, which will be read by John. In each of our programmes for the next 4 weeks, we will play you a short item from Hertfordshire Trading Standards, telling us how we can avoid being tricked into giving our money or revealing our personal details to bogus traders. And the first one is in this programme. Then we have David Arson, this time talking about English music. After that, we have broadcaster and former sportsman Tom McNabb talking about heroes. And finally, we'll have this week's birthdays and events this week in past times. This week's music is called Running Water's Full and is by Gothby. So now the news. And for our readers today, we have Gilly, Ian, Jenny and Wendy.
Hello, I'm Gilly. More cash needed to finish town's new leisure and cultural centres after delays to construction. More cash will be needed to be borrowed to complete Harpenden's flagship new leisure and cultural centres, district councillors have warned. The extra costs were incurred following issues with the roof and delays caused by the coronavirus pandemic. The overall construction bill for the Rothamsted Park project will now rise from the £18.4 million estimated early this year, but the exact figure has yet to be determined. SADC has already borrowed £13.5 million for the project, with additional finance from other sources, including the redevelopment of Harpenden Public Halls. The Cabinet has now recommended more money should be borrowed to ensure the new centres can be completed. Councillor Robert Donald, portfolio holder for commercial, development and wellbeing, said, "I inherited this redevelopment project when building construction was already well advanced on site. We really have no choice but to ask full council to allow for the extra borrowing to see this vital project through to the end. The alternative of stopping work on building the cultural centre would leave a half-finished building, expose the council to more, not less, contractual costs, and result in Harpenden residents not being able to use a great new facility." New government guidance was issued after the contract was signed, which meant the roof had to be substantially rebuilt to meet higher structural standards. "We have a public duty to meet these new requirements, and it is the sort of difficulty that all large refurbishment projects involving existing buildings like these can run into. What has, of course, also been completely unexpected is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, which resulted in a need for social distancing on the construction sites. The resultant delays have inevitably led to the construction budget rising, and we are going to have to bear some of the costs of that. As part of the project, the existing swimming pool building is being turned into the new leisure centre. It will include an improved gym, new cafe, sports hall, sauna, steam room, learner pool, and refurbished main pool. The nearby sports centre is being converted into a cultural centre, replacing the ageing public halls in South Down Road. It will include a 511-seat theatre, two function rooms, an exhibition space, bars on two floors, and a cafe overlooking the park. The leisure centre is due to open later this year, and the cultural centre is set to open in 2021. A residential and commercial development will be built on the present public hall site when the new cultural centre is open. During building work, it was discovered that the sports centre's roof was not strong enough for extra plant and more beams would have to be installed. Social distancing at the construction site is resulting in around 1 week's delay for each month of the contract. Conservative group leader, Councillor Mary Maynard, said, "Yet again, this administration demonstrates its inability to manage straightforward construction projects. The council has 9 large construction projects. All are running behind schedule and only one is on budget. This is not unforeseen problems on one project. It is a pattern of incompetence. In April 2019, Conservatives left an excellent project team. Apparently, now that the costs are getting away from them, it is the staff's fault and they need to renegotiate with suppliers. Anyone with construction project experience knows problems are inevitable and negotiations are challenging. It is up to whoever is in charge to keep a project on time and to budget. The Liberal Democrats are in charge and are failing. They lost the key managers in the council project team, and through their inability to take decisions, problem solve, and effectively manage the external construction company, look like they are losing control of the project. The news comes after it was revealed the cost of the new city centre opportunity site south in St Albans had increased from £60 million to £65.8 million.
Hello, I'm Ian. Charter market crisis. How restrictions hurt traders. Could the coronavirus restrictions spell the end of St Albans charter market? That is the fear of traders and customers following new measures brought in to enforce social distancing. These include reducing the number of stalls and rotating them fortnightly. The market has been trading every Wednesday and Saturday since around the 9th or 10th century and was granted a royal charter by Edward VI in 1553. Traders used to have a stall erected for them as part of the fee they pay to set up on the market. But although the payment has remained the same, stallholders now have to assemble their own stall or gazebo and dismantle it at the end of the day. The general feeling when this newspaper spoke to traders is one of fear of being named for reprisal. One stallholder, part of a family business that has traded for over 50 years on St Albans Market on Saturdays and more recently Wednesdays, said he cannot make money selling what he sells by only being there once a fortnight. This is going to potentially ruin our businesses. The council tells St Albans residents that it makes a huge loss every year. I fail to see how that can be the case when every stall pays £40 to £51 minimum per day. Although traders are scared of speaking out, they have been raising awareness of the problems with their customers. Market shopper John Breen said, "The street traders have been told that for fairness for social distancing, they can only trade once every 2 weeks. The shopkeepers say that the street traders bring in business. If SADC kill the market, they will destroy the city centre." Resident Michael Shaw of Little Acre said in an open letter to St Albans District Council, "Yesterday, on my weekly visit to the market to purchase fruit and veg, I was informed by 2 traders that, as from Saturday, July the 25th, they were only allowed to trade fortnightly. As a long-time resident of St Albans, I have watched with dismay the gradual decline of a once vibrant and dynamic city. The small, interesting shops have long gone, being replaced by coffee shops, estate agents, and now phone shops, making St Albans no different from other cities. The market was the remaining jewel to attract the public, yet no effort is being made to protect and support its traders." Manager of Crepe Affair, David Thomas, also holds this view. "As a shop, we rely on traders to bring extra business and compromise is key. Come Christmas, it could be a very bleak St Albans." Resident Sally Audley said, "It concerns me gravely that our local businesses are being unfairly treated by business enforcement and under the guise of COVID-19 pandemic rules and laws. The market is failing. Under these hastily invented rules and laws, the market stalls traditionally stored and put up by the council have been removed until further notice. How can anyone run a business selling any product, let alone fresh foods, if they are not allowed to set up and do so under these rules? The council says the restrictions have been necessary due to the pandemic." Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Tourism and Culture, explained, "Our market traders are an immensely important part of our local community and economy. With multiple stakeholders, differing needs, government safety regulations and a pandemic to deal with, running the market is not as simple as people might wish it to be. The council's job is to balance the differing needs of everyone and ensure that people remain safe in what is a very worrying and continuing state of emergency. From the 1st of August, we will be looking to increase the market, using High Street, which required landowner permissions, and the area around the Auburn Arena. We have to consider the needs of retailers too. The government has now relaxed guidelines so that shops and pubs can be licensed to put chairs and tables outside. This is helping them to continue to run their businesses. But on market days, they can't do that because space is limited. I'm also concerned about the needs of people with disabilities. Things have altered the city centre landscape, and for people who are visually impaired, for example, this has meant many are unable to come into town to do their shopping as usual.
Hello, I'm Jenny. Council bids for city centre building. A city centre retail and office block on the market for £7.2 million could be bought by the District Council as part of its latest foray into property management. SADC is planning to buy Lockie House, the building that currently includes Barclays Bank and Virgin Money among its tenants. The Cabinet, the Council's executive, approved moves to purchase the freehold of the property at a meeting last week. This is subject to the completion of full legal and building checks, as well as evaluation by an independent property surveyor. A significant offer has secured its position as the preferred bidder. Building work is underway nearby at the Civic Centre Opportunity Site South, which was formerly occupied by the police station and an NHS clinic. It is being transformed into adjacent blocks of flats and commercial space. Councillors say the purchase of Lockie House will enable them to manage the whole area more effectively and to shape the economic mix of uses for shoppers, businesses and residents, while also providing future redevelopment options. It is also intended to create new annual revenue, as the rental income should be more than the repayments for the 50-year loan to buy the building. Councillor Robert Donald, portfolio holder for Commercial Development and Wellbeing, said, "This is a unique opportunity to acquire one of the biggest and most prominent commercial buildings in our High Street, which will enable us to protect and support the city's economic life. We believe we should not miss this opportunity. It is an ambitious acquisition in terms of our commitment to shape and regenerate this area. However, I am convinced that this investment will provide value for money for our residents in the years ahead. Given the regeneration we have already started nearby, it makes sense to acquire an interest in this property estate. There is still much work to do in carrying out due diligence as regards the state of the building itself and legal requirements. Full Council will have to agree the increase of our capital budget to enable this investment to happen. However, I am confident that now we are the preferred bidder, we can negotiate a good deal which reflects the present COVID-19 situation and the financial opportunity this purchase offers us and our taxpayers."
Hello, Wendy here. My first story has implications for local democracy. The heading is, "Could Hearts Unitary Authority save £142 million a year?" Estimates suggest that replacing all 10 of Hertfordshire's district and borough councils with a single unitary council could save £142 million a year. At a meeting of Hertfordshire County Council on Tuesday last week, council leader David Williams revealed that the county council had commissioned consultants to look at options for the future of Hertfordshire. This comes after the announcement of the government's wish for two-tier authorities, such as Hertfordshire, to move to a unitary model. Leaders of all 10 district and borough councils have already publicly vowed to oppose any plans for a single unitary authority, but Councillor Williams said the change could deliver improved and more efficient services as well as substantial savings. He said, "We have achieved a huge amount working with the structures that we have, but these very structures are fast approaching their limit in terms of the changing economic and social environment." It was suggested during the meeting that replacing the current system with one unitary council could save up to £142 million a year. Replacing it with two could save £105 million a year. Those figures are believed to be part of a presentation that has been shared with leading councillors across the county. Councillor Terry Hone, Executive Member for Community Safety and Waste Management, told the meeting that merging waste services could save up to £22 million alone. Councillor Williams initially raised the issue in a statement at the meeting, which meant that it was not debated, although it was referred to in some questions to the executive later. This was questioned by Labour leader Councillor Judy Billing and Liberal Democrat leader of the opposition Councillor Stephen Giles Medhurst. Councillor Billing said it was an enormously important and massively biased statement and said that it was extraordinary to allow the statement but not debate. Meanwhile, Councillor Charles Medhurst wondered whether a special council meeting needed to be called to discuss the statement and asked whether statements on potential financial savings would be made available. Council Chairman Councillor Colette Wyatt-Lowe told the meeting that there would be an opportunity to debate this in much more depth at a later date. Under Hertfordshire's existing two-tier system, the 10 district and borough councils provide a range of services such as planning, environmental health, bin collection, housing and licensing. The county council provides services such as education, libraries, social care, highways and the fire service. Under a unitary system, all services would be provided by a single council. At the meeting, Councillor Williams pointed to cost, complexity and overlap in the current system, specifically highlighting the allowances currently paid to 526 councillors across Hertfordshire. He added, "We can deliver improved and more efficient services, joining up agendas such as social care and housing that at present require 10 different sets of relationships to be developed. We know that structural reform could also result in substantial savings for the public purse, placing Hertfordshire in a more secure situation in the face of an uncertain financial outlook." Councillor Williams pointed to government-declared intentions to strengthen local institution, including establishing more unitary authorities. He also reported that he had met with district and borough council leaders last Tuesday to consider government plans for devolution and local government reform. Within days of that meeting, those leaders, representing all political parties, published a statement opposing a move towards a unitary authority. Mr. Williams described this as disappointing and said that they seemed intent on ruling out options without considering the savings and efficiencies that could be made. He also said that there was a need to look at authorities such as Durham, Cornwall, Wiltshire and Buckinghamshire that had established unitary authorities. As well as options for a single unitary council, there have been suggestions that Hertfordshire could be split into two or more unitary authorities.
Petition for Safer A5183 given to County Council. More than 1,800 people have backed a petition calling for a safe route for cyclists, runners and pedestrians alongside the hazardous A5183 in Redbourne. The existing road is said to have become extremely hazardous and often dangerous over the last few years, and on Tuesday, cycle shop owner Simon Barnes presented the petition to councillors. The petition points to several cycling fatalities on the stretch of road and says the existing footpath is poorly maintained and not inviting for cyclists. It calls for a safe route for cyclists, runners and walkers along the road. The safe route would link to the Nicky Line, which connects Hemel Hempstead and Harpenden with other existing routes to St Albans. Mr Barnes, who has lived in Redbourne for 17 years and now runs a cafe and cycle shop, told councillors there was a need to capitalise on the recent resurgence of cycling. He said that in his many decades involved in cycling, he had never seen such a big and rapid increase in cycling as he had brought about by COVID-19. No safe route exists to St Albans apart from the death trap that is the former A5 between St Albans and Redbourne, he said. According to Mr. Barnes, a pop-up, temporary or permanent cycle lane, which he said would meet the criteria that the government's Emergency Active Travel Fund requires, would improve the route. Previous road traffic calming measures have been challenging on this dangerous piece of road, with 18 deaths and nearly 50 major accidents recently, he continued. A cycle lane that narrows the existing road space will, by default, improve concentration and speed compliance. At the meeting of the full council, the petition was accepted by Executive Member for Highways and the Environment, Councillor Phil Bibby. Councillor Bibby said the council was fully aware of the challenges on this stretch of road between Redbourne and St Albans, which has a chequered accident history. He said it was recognised that this would not be considered as a viable route by anyone other than confident users. He added that a number of changes had been made to the route over the past 15 years, but challenges remained, and funding from the Emergency Active Travel Fund was a great opportunity to address the issues. Councillor Bibby said cycling groups, district and county councillors had been consulted, and now more than 100 schemes would be put into priority order. Unfortunately, it will not be possible to deliver all these projects within the funding budget and timescale, he said. Though I would like to assure you that the A5183 will be given due consideration, and we are conscious of the massive local support. There are clearly difficulties in delivering a cycle route along the A5183, but equally significant benefits to those cycling and the adjacent walking network, if it can be achieved. Meanwhile, Liberal Democrat Councillor Chris White, who is also leader of the St Albans District Council, said it was vital to have modal shift. He said there would be snags and that it would never be straightforward to put in a cycle lane because you are depriving another road user of space. But after highlighting its past as a three-lane highway, he said, "If this is not the right time, I don't know when there is, because traffic is lighter, and I think the public will to get some benefit out of the COVID emergency has never been higher." Labour councillor Drida Gordon welcomed the petition and said, "If this isn't a scheme that's going to be prioritised from this particular pot of money, then I think we need to be looking at other measures. These must be put in place in order to make that a safer route for cyclists, either with a dedicated cycle pathway or to make the road a great deal safer than it is now." The petition was supported by County Councillor Annie Brewster at its inception in June. At the time, she said, "It is absolutely fabulous to see so many people out on bikes in our district, but we need many more safe connective routes, particularly as vehicular traffic starts to return." The petition will now be referred to officers for consideration and report to the local councillor and political group spokesman.
Business aid. Businesses struggling in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic are missing out on vital grants which could help them keep afloat. The District Council has around £1.25 million from the government's Local Authority Discretionary Grants Fund to help support eligible businesses. The financial aid is non-repayable and intended to help firms survive the impact of the pandemic, but so far only £355,000 has been paid to just 39 businesses. It is thought many others are missing out, and so a second round of applications will run until Sunday, August the 16th. The grants are largely to help with property costs, and applicants must not have received cash from the government's other COVID-related schemes. They should be classed as small or micro and have seen a significant drop in income due to COVID-19 restrictions. These could include regular market traders, bed and breakfast establishments, charities and firms that share offices.
City hits a small screen with first ever TV advert to get visitors back. St Albans Cathedral is the centre of attention in the city's first ever TV advert, which aims to attract visitors back this summer. The video, which is voiced by Panto legend Bob Golding, will illustrate why the city is good for a day out or staycation destination. The advert, which launched on July 15th and will be seen across multiple Sky TV channels until August 13th, encourages domestic visitors to come for the day, then come back and stay. It has been put together by St Albans BID, who received a £10,000 advertising grant from Sky to fund the production. The video highlights St Albans' unique history and heritage, its vast open spaces, its markets, food and drink and independent shopping, and why it is a safe place to visit in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. It features local businesses and their families, including traders from Infuse, Abigail's, Samir, Chloe James, the White Lion, and Ye Old Fighting Cock staff. And the drone footage was donated for free. Co-chairs of St Albans BID, Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Culture and Tourism, and Sarah Gillow, owner of Jewellers Gallio, said, "This is the first time St Albans has ever dipped its toe into TV advertising and we're really excited about it. Our fantastic city, with its many attractions, shops, restaurants, pubs and hotels, is open again to welcome visitors during the summer and beyond, and we really wanted to shout about it and to actually show people the beauty of this thriving ancient place just a stone's throw from London and what it has to offer. The city's 2,000-year history is rich and dramatic and is a huge draw to visitors. The heart of the city is the 11th-century cathedral, on the site of which Britain's first martyr, and therefore saint, was executed, and in which the first draft of Magna Carta was drawn up. All of our retail and hospitality businesses have worked hard to ensure that they will meet the COVID-19 health and safety guidelines. The TV advert is the first step in a new strategy to promote the cathedral city as a great place to visit, whatever your age or interests."
Businesses praise Street Market Initiative for saving them. City centre businesses have praised the Inside Out Market Initiative for saving them from ruin. The impact of the coronavirus lockdown had a devastating impact on local retailers as they were forced to close up shop and furlough staff. Even though many strive to maintain an online presence, the lack of passing trade hit revenues hard and many struggle to survive. But with the easing of restrictions, the St Albans BID, the Business Improvement District, introduced Inside Out, giving retailers the opportunity to trade outdoors with plenty of space for social distancing. A new Friday market was also launched in High Street, which has been temporarily closed for traffic. Owner of Waddington Road Coffee and Kitchen, Mike Lanfill, said, "We bought this van to serve out of with the council grant we were given as a small business. It enabled us to trade while the cafe was closed. Being out in High Street means we are doing really well. This has been a lifesaver for us as the footfall reduced. Bridal shop and suit hire Ceremonia has consolidated to their High Street building as the BID initiative is bringing more footfall and helping them boost their sales." Ceremonia owners Helen Searle and Andrew Massey said, "There are some great spaces to continue the market now that the road is pedestrianised due to the pandemic. The more businesses that survive, the better it will be for St Albans as a whole." Anastasia Daniels of confectionery business Rock Pop Candy said, "It is a great feel to it, very upbeat, friendly, and of course alfresco in its feel. I've had a positive response from customers who enjoy shopping for items while outdoors, and it gives me the opportunity to catch up with regulars while still at a distance with PPE, but in a relaxed, spacious manner. As an ex-shopkeeper, it allows me the opportunity to continue trading and keep my business afloat." Samir Berry from Infuse Modern Indian Bistro added, "The market has received a good response, and we have seen an increase in footfall as more and more locals come to know about the market. It creates a buzz and an excuse for people to come out of their houses and shop. The market helps us to get the restaurant's name out there, which is great in these testing times." Inside Out is a joint initiative between the District Council and the BID based on central government strategy for local economic recovery and includes market traders.
Whipsnade, A Day at the Zoo with Social Distancing. A personal report by Amy Thorburn. Annual trips to Whipsnade Zoo since my childhood have often provided a respite from reality. A day to escape the daily grind of normality and admire what nature has to offer. A post-lockdown visit was inevitable. The economic struggle of zoos during the pandemic was difficult to bear, and it felt the least I could do for the place that enabled so many of my fondest memories. A full day out can still be daunting, torn between safety concerns and wanting to escape the banality of lockdown. Whipsnade is the perfect location to test the waters after lockdown, as the largest zoo in the country, the vast majority of which is outside and remarkably open compared with other zoos in the UK. It was also midweek, and usually that would mean only a handful of other visitors around the park. This was the first unexpected surprise. The sheer number of visitors, especially with the new pre-booking measures to restrict the amount of guests, it felt overpopulated in the climate that we have become accustomed to, awkwardly shuffling past other zoo-goers and trying to navigate paths with some people trying to socially distance and others completely unbothered by brushing shoulders with total strangers. It felt almost taboo when someone entered your 2 metre bubble to catch a glimpse of a rhino. Whipsnade does feel safe and is probably one of the least risky places to spend a day out. The only point of contact you would need to have is with the toilet facilities, which are one household in, one household out, and they had hand sanitizer located outside. In theory, the zoo works very well and very safely. Whipsnade has done everything they can to pandemic-proof their facilities. In practice, it doesn't entirely work. Animal care providers, or those serving coffee, cannot be expected to police social distancing. It's up to the guests on the day to adhere to the government guidelines and basic human decency to try and avoid others. For the most part, that was done very well. People sat on the grass away from one another. Most people tried to move out of the way when walking on the same path. But when it comes to viewing the animals, social distancing went out the door. The crux of the issue is that although Whipsnade boasts 600 acres of land, that doesn't mean each person will be equally spread out at 2 metre intervals at all times throughout the day. That land is taken up by enclosures, indoor areas, inaccessible areas, roads, paths, buildings, a train line, and a drive-through safari. Only a fraction of the land constitutes area where you can view the animals, and around the enclosures there are hot spots to view them. People will congregate there because they have paid to see the animals, and when it came to choosing between seeing the tigers, or the elephants, or the lions, people chose getting a good view of the animal over social distancing. At times, it felt cramped. The zoo was fairly busy and full of children who obviously aren't prioritising staying away from others. The queue to enter the lion's viewing area was heaving. The area around the tiger exhibit had a constant flow of people coming and going, which made it difficult to even walk past without being close to another group. The zoo has done what they can to restrict contact with other guests, but some people are more interested in seeing the animals or relaxing for a day to ensure they stay apart from others. Entertainment-wise, it was lacking. No animal talks, and importantly for parents, no play area. One of the best parts of the zoo is the talks, learning about the animals' personalities. Their very relatable obsession with food adds another level of personalization and brings the zoo to life. For the most part, it was a great reprieve away from the lockdown and a great breath of fresh air. The only issue was the aversion of some to stand on the marked-out paw prints. Whipsnade Zoo is struggling after experiencing massive revenue losses due to the COVID-19 restrictions. It costs the zoo £500,000 a year to care for its herd of Asian elephants, with the coronavirus crisis costing the zoo around £2.3 million per month. Before the zoo was reopened, key staff was still needed to care for the animals, with 280 staff members furloughed. In May, the Zoological Society of London, ZSL, said the zoo needed £25 million to stay afloat.
Celebrity advert. Famous comedians have backed Sir David Attenborough's appeal to keep Whipsnade and its sister site in London open as they face financial troubles following the coronavirus lockdown. A host of stars, including Jonathan Ross and Catherine Tate, are lining up behind Sir David Attenborough to support ZSL in its hour of need, with a star-studded TV ad which debuted on Channel 5 and across Sky channels last week. The famous comedians voice zoo animals plotting ways to save the zoo, including a technologically inept giraffe, two hip hashtagging lemurs, and a spiritual gorilla. The launch of an appeal by Sir David Attenborough, calling on the public to protect ZSL, the charity behind the zoos, has attracted the support of a flock of famous comedians, including Bill Bailey, Alan Carr, Dame Baptiste, and Shaja Mirza, who are all voicing animals. The short film shows Bob, the Emperor Tamarind monkey, voiced by Bill Bailey, sharing a zoo marketing meeting with his furred and feathered colleagues to discuss how to raise urgent funds, with Barnu, London Zoo's male Asiatic lion, landing on the winning idea through an accidental screen freeze. ZSL, the international conservation charity behind London and Whipsnade Zoos, is running its biggest ever fundraising drive to ensure its groundbreaking science, global conservation work, and two world-class zoos can survive in the face of major financial losses. Relying on the power of laughter to raise money, the charity hopes to claw back some of the income lost due to the coronavirus-enforced zoo closures, with an aim of generating £1 million a month. Bill Bailey said, "I knew ZSL and its two zoos were struggling with the devastating effects of the pandemic, and I wanted to help in any way I could. I was delighted to voice Bob the Tamarin to support their appeal, as it's for an excellent cause. I've worked with ZSL on a number of occasions to raise awareness and support for their important conservation projects for threatened species, but now they're the ones at risk. This is how I can help." ZSL Director General Dominic Jeremy said, "The closure of London and Whipsnade Zoos put us under immense financial pressure. We're fighting our biggest challenge in our 200-year history. The situation ZSL is facing is anything but funny."
This is the Westminster Diary by St Albans MP Daisy Cooper. Last days of Parliament ahead of summer recess. This week saw the final few days of the parliamentary term before the summer recess. That means that while some MPs are still working, they won't be meeting as a group in Parliament to debate and vote on new laws. The Russia report was finally published, but whether it contained a smoking gun or not fell down to party lines. The government was quick to say there was no evidence of Russian interference, and opposition MPs pointed out that this was because the government hadn't looked for any. As predicted, there was a take-out-the-trash day, publishing new and usually unpopular policies online, where few people will see them without any formal announcement and when it's too late for them to be scrutinised. Perhaps the most ominous looking of these was that number 10 is taking direct control of government data policy. In operational terms, this might be a good thing. The government's digital transformation could do with a top-level push. But the question is one of scrutiny and accountability. Dominic Cummings is famous for breaking the rules and not apologising and working for Vote Leave, which was fined for using data without consent during the EU referendum. When he is the one in charge of centralising government data and power, alarm bells start to ring. Strangely, the government also sneaked out an announcement that, in my view, should have been shouted from the rooftops. A call for evidence on how to fix the broken business rate system that is killing our high streets. Just 2 weeks earlier, I had written to the government with the support of 20 MPs calling for this review to be turbocharged, so it was nice to secure an end-of-term win. Finally, as MPs shuffled through the voting lobby for the final time before September, some wearing masks, some not, we exchanged small talk about summer plans. Many were going to catch up on emails, some were hoping for a holiday abroad via an air bridge. Most were planning a staycation. the week closed with the air bridge to Spain being suspended. Thousands of Brits, including the Secretary of State for Transport, will now have to quarantine when they return from holiday. It serves as a stark reminder that there is no recess from the COVID crisis this summer.
Hundreds turn out for beloved pub landlord Mr. Curley's send-off. Thousands of pounds have been raised to celebrate the life of Sandridge landlord Carlton, Mr. Curley Holding, who has died at age 53. The friends of the pub manager, who sadly lost his battle with cancer, raised the money to celebrate his life. On Monday, July 20th, hundreds of people paid their respects to Carlton, who was the manager of the Queen's Head in Sandridge, but died on June 21st after losing his fight against cancer. Known for being reliable and his dry sense of humour, friends took it upon themselves to raise £5,468 to fund a celebration of his life. Tara Stoker, fundraising organiser, said, "Sadly, we lost our dear friend, Mr. Curley, to his battle against cancer, so we decided to raise money to give him the funeral and send-off he deserves." Reverend Kate Damond, assistant curate at St. Leonard's Church, Sandridge, led a simple alfresco service at 1 p.m. before the funeral procession passed 200 yards down the high street to the Sandridge football ground for a final farewell. David West, director of West & Sons Funeral, said, "Curley was returned to his home, the Queen's Head, for a small service. Then a procession through Sandridge, turning left from the Queen's Head through the village and a right turn to the football club with everyone following on foot. Curley had some priceless friends who are determined to celebrate his life, and we are delighted to help them to do this." Following the funeral, Tara added, "It was absolutely amazing, such a great turnout. There was hundreds of people who turned up. West & Sons helped us so much. They saved us. We didn't even know if we'd be able to get the body back, and they helped us every step of the way. They were great. We have around £3,500 left from the donations, so we are donating it to Linden Home, which is run by the Salvation Army and next door to the pub where Curley used to go. We are also donating some towards the hospice he was at and to the local church in the village. Special thanks have been given to the Kestrel Grove Residential and Nursing Home in Hive Road, Bushy Heath, for the love and palliative care they afforded him in his final days."
A former St. Albans and Harpenden salesman turned poet has been personally thanked by the Queen for his poignant verses after he sent her two of his poetic musings. John Hollingsworth has been a keen writer for many years, having a talent for coming up with witty rhymes and verses in a matter of minutes. However, a lady-in-waiting responded to John on behalf of Queen Elizabeth, a gesture he says has helped him gain more confidence ahead of him turning his lifelong hobby into a business. The letter said, "The Queen wishes me to write and thank you for your poem, in which you express your continuing loyalty and support for Her Majesty during the current situation. The Queen much appreciates your kind thought for her at this time and hopes that you too are keeping safe and well. I am to thank you very much once again for your poignant verses." One of John's poems was a reflection of the current coronavirus crisis, with the second being an ode to the Queen. Part of his poem for the Queen read, "You've led us for years through good times and tears. You're steady and calm and kept us from harm. As many a Brit will profess, if we didn't have you at the rudder, ma'am, we'd be all at sea in distress." The 63-year-old said, "I thought I'd be surprised if I got a response, and it was good for my self-esteem, and it was really exciting. I'm really a wordsmith. I can make up a poem about anything. I worked in advertising for many years, but I've always been more into music, poetry, and writing. I've also been writing bespoke poetry for 40 years, just giving it away, and with my age and furloughing and the potential financial Armageddon looming, I'm thinking I should be making a living out of this. His coronavirus poem, named Not Here, Not Now, highlights that many coronavirus-related deaths were treated as numbers and encourages the reader to remember the person. John is in the process of creating a website for his new business, which will allow people to request bespoke poetry for any occasion.
Summer Postbox Toppers. Would you believe it? The Yarn Bombers are back with a delightful dozen postbox toppers for the summer. The creative fundraiser follows in the footsteps of the traditional Christmas event and is organised by St Albans-based agency Atlas Translations Limited and crochet creative Candy Stewart and her team of knitting enthusiasts. A total of 12 postboxes have been yarn bombed with floral arrangements crafted from wool, with the aim of raising the spirits of the local community, while also raising money for charities that are in desperate need of funds due to a drop in revenue and a rise in demand for their services because of the pandemic. Funds raised will be divided between Open Door and St Albans and District Food Bank.
And now the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Heart Advertiser. Patricia Berry, aged 79 years. Sheila Edmondson. Alan Hopkins, aged 94. John Hunt, aged 93. Derek Mytham, aged 91. And Edgar Pierce, aged 95. Now, a little more of our piece of music by Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of good bits of national radio coming up this week.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, August 1st. Plenty of drama to consider. At 1pm on Radio 4 Extra is an Agatha Christie Miss Marple dramatisation, A Caribbean Mystery, starring June Whitfield, in which the peace of a beautiful tropical island is shattered by the photograph of a murderer. Then at 3pm on Radio 4, the Martin Beck killings continue with The Locked Room. Swedish detective Martin Beck has to solve the murder of a man who is shot dead and his body discovered in a sealed room, but with no gun. At 9pm on Radio 4 comes the first part of the drama Tracks Strata. Matthew Broughton's conspiracy thriller returns with a prequel to the first series, set 36 years previously. Rachel is looking for fossils with her four-year-old son, Joe. But when a freak earthquake strikes, Joe vanishes. The 2017 Wreath Lectures continue on Radio 4 at 7:15pm with the twice-winning Booker Prize historical novelist Hilary Mantel. This week in Silence Grips the Town, she tells the story of a Polish dramatist who was obsessed with the French Revolution and lived in a self-imposed poverty and isolation and died unknown in 1935. Finally, for Saturday, August 1st, some light relief with Radio 2's virtual folk festival at 8pm on Radio 2. On what would have been the weekend of the Cambridge Folk Festival, Mark Radcliffe presents an imaginary lineup of established folk giants and newcomers, all performing from their homes. Suzanne Vega and Yusuf, also known of course as Cat Stevens, are two of the stars. Sunday, August 2nd, starts with Lauren Laverne's Castaway on Desert Island Discs, TV naturalist Steve Backshall. Tune in at 11am on Radio 4, and it's repeated on Friday, August 7th at 9am. The food programme at 12:30 on Radio 4 looks at how COVID-19 has and will change the restaurant industry. Sheila Dillon talks to those in the industry, plus its customers, and also reports on how one restaurant in London is preparing to reopen after months of lockdown. Again, if you miss it, it's repeated on Monday, August 3rd, 3:30pm. in Radio 4's book club at 4pm, James Naugherty and novelist Louise Welsh discuss Robbie Louis Stevenson's 1886 adventure, Kidnapped. Repeated again on Thursday, August 6th at 3:30pm. Then to Radio 2 at 7pm for Sunday night is Music Night. This week, the BBC big band and jazz vocalists Leanne Carroll, Claire Martin and Ian Shaw perform a musical tribute to Frank Sinatra, recorded in November 2015 at Sage Gateshead to mark the 100th anniversary of Sinatra's birth. So, on to those programmes, which are broadcast each day at the same time, Monday to Friday. 5 days a week. Here we go. Book of the Week at 9:45am on Radio 4 each day is The Oak Papers. Jonathan Keeble reads from James Canton's account of the history and symbolic power of oak trees and their vital importance in history and myth. It's repeated each night at 12:30. The 15-minute drama at 10:45am on Radio 4 is Bloody Esterford. Welsh inspector Daff Daffis is looking forward to some sun, sea and rest on a Greek island when the largest music and poetry festival in Europe comes to town. But his holiday is cancelled as there's a murder to solve. Again, repeated each evening at 7:45pm. Composer of the Week at 12 noon each day on Radio 3 is African-American composer William Grant Still, born in 1895. The opening programme looks at the encouragement of his single-parent mother, his transformative period of study with the modernist composer Edgard Varese, who becomes his mentor. At just after midday on Radio 4 each day, Anne Enright continues to read from her novel Actress, about fame, sex and a daughter's search for truth. It's repeated as Book of Bedtime at 10:45pm each evening, again Monday to Friday all this week. How They Made Us Doubt Everything continues each day at 1:45pm on Radio 4. Peter Pomerantsev looks at the tactics used by companies to change the narrative on big stories, from climate change to the link between smoking and cancer. On Radio 4 Extra at 8:30pm each evening, it's the dramatisation of Robert Harris's 1992 thriller Fatherland, set in an imaginary Hitler-led post-war Germany. Finally, at 10:45pm each evening on Radio 3 is the Essay to the Barricades. American author and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb recalls the books and films that he and his contemporaries were reading and watching before the 1968 student unrest in Paris, Prague, London and New York. And he starts with Joseph Heller's Catch-22. On to highlights for Monday, August 3rd. And there's a new series of The Patch at 9am on Radio 4, in which a postcode is randomly selected each week, and presenter Polly Weston can find herself dispatched to anywhere in the UK. This week it's EC4V5 comes up, the City of London. So begins a remarkable story about homelessness during lockdown in the City of London. Drama at 2pm is entitled Festival on Radio 4, a comedy drama about the start of a famous literary romance where in 1962 novelist Elizabeth Jane Howard took on the job of running the Cheltenham Literary Festival. It has to be a baptism of fire. Finally, for Monday, August 3rd, the extraordinary story of Anthony Ray Hinton, who spent almost three decades on death row in the United States. To get through, he set up a book club for himself and five inmates. Listen to his story in the Death Row Book Club, 8pm, Radio 4, and repeated on Wednesday, August 5th at 11am. On to Tuesday, August 4th, and in with the great pleasure at 11:30am on Radio 4, singer Charlotte Church presents a selection of the writing that means the most to her. Includes extracts from Roald Dahl, Mark Twain and Carl Sagan. Then at 2:15pm on Radio 4, the continuation of the drama Holding Back the Tide. This week Hector has a new campaign to halt the decline of good manners in Breck Hoe. But it's not long before his own manners are called into question. Front Row at 7:15pm on Radio 4 tonight reviews Blindness, a socially distanced sound installation at the Donmar Warehouse in London, exploring the panic caused by an epidemic in which a city's inhabitants suddenly go blind. On to Radio 3 at 7:30 for a revisit of the 2015 BBC Proms. Finnish chief conductor Sakari Oramo conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra in an all Sibelius programme as part of the 150th anniversary celebrations. The works are Nsaga and Kalevo. Then at 8pm on Radio 4, in Taking on Trump, James Naughtie tells the story of the Democratic Party's nomination race for a challenger to Donald Trump, painting a portrait of the winner, Joe Biden. Repeated, if you miss it, Sunday, August 9th, 5pm. And as ever, on a Tuesday, it's followed at 8:40pm by In Touch with Peter White. Cricket fans will be keen to tune in to Test Match Special on Wednesday, August 5th on Radio 5 Live, extra for day one of the first test between England and Pakistan. All-day coverage from Manchester's Old Trafford starts at 10:25am. After England's victory over the West Indies, we hope for more. Today's drama at 2:15pm on Radio 4 is My Mother Taught Me to Sing. Two men negotiate the adoption process and attempt to discover what it takes to be a parent. In Women Talking About Cars at 6:30pm on Radio 4, Victoria Corin Mitchell's guest is Claudia Winkleman, who touches on the joys of the black cab and the sentimental value of an ageing Volkswagen. Over to Radio 3 for another revisit to the BBC Proms, this time a July 2007 concert from the Royal Albert Hall. The Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra performed Beethoven's Overture, Leonora No. 3, Barber's Violin Concerto, and Copland's Symphony No. 3. Then on Radio 2 at 9pm is the weekly folk show with Mark Radcliffe, in which he showcases traditional and contemporary folk music from here and abroad. And back to Radio 3 at 10pm for the Secrets of the Music Reading panel. Charlotte Higgins investigates how the BBC choose new pieces of music for performance and broadcast. She focuses on the early years of the BBC, also the 1940s and 50s, when a new spirit of adventure and experiment arrived in concert halls and academies. Crossing Continents on Radio 4 at 11am on Thursday, August 6th, is entitled Algeria's Plague Revisited. Lucy Ash visits the French-Algerian city of Oran, the setting for Albert Camus's 1947 novel The Plague, and explores the parallels between the novel and today's real-life pandemic. Some of the lines from the novel read like a current news bulletin. The drama at 2:15pm is Courtyards in My Closet. In 1931, when writer Daff James's grandmother was 5 years old, her father took her to see grandparents in North Wales. He promptly revealed a shocking secret and left soon after, never to return. Here Daff sets out to explore the skeletons in his family's closet. This is followed at 3pm on Radio 4 by Open Country. This week, Helen Marks goes in search of an urban flora and hears from a French botanist who's decided to start chalking the names of plants next to them to draw people's attention downwards. And botanist Phil Gartz tells the story of weeds and reveals how 90 years ago Edward Salisbury, who has become director of the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew Gardens in London, discovered how seeds could be picked up and transferred vast distances on the soles of our shoes. It's repeated if you miss it on Thursday, on Saturday, August 8th, at just after 6am. And finally for this week, Friday, August 7th, and drama on Radio 4 Extra at 10am with Arthur Conan Doyle's classic Sherlock Holmes murder mystery, The Hound of the Baskervilles, starring Judi Dench and Donald Sinden. More drama at 2:15pm on Radio 4 this time, entitled Wild Swimming. This is the story of Nell and Oscar, two lovers bound together for eternity on a deserted beach in Dorset. Nell is sick of the limitations she faces, while Oscar, an aspiring poet, flits in and out of her life. An astute drama on the differences between the sexes and the way in which social privilege affects life choices. On Radio 3, for The Nature of Creativity, Mary Colwell asks whether human encroachment on the natural world is compromising our ability to express ourselves artistically. From cave paintings to folk tales, Greek drama to Beethoven, she identifies connections between nature and human society. That's on Friday afternoon, August 7th. And finally, a complete change of scene with Classic FM's Smooth Classics to round off the week. Starting at 10 p.m, enjoy 3 hours of relaxing music with Margarita Taylor, designed to ease the stresses and strains of the day, which we all need at the moment. As ever, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
And now, the first of our four short items by Susan Shanahan from Hearts Trading Standards about protecting ourselves from bogus traders.
My name is Susan Shanahan from Hertfordshire Trading Standards, and I've been asked to pass on some information about some of the different COVID-19 scams we've been seeing around the country, how you can access support and keep yourself safe from the fraudsters. Now, we've seen fraudsters using some horrible tricks and tactics to exploit people's fears and vulnerabilities for their own financial gain. According to Action Fraud, it's estimated that £2 million has already been lost to coronavirus scams in the UK. Now, five tips to avoid scams at any time. Firstly, you're contacted out of the blue. You really don't know if the caller is actually who they say they are. So tell them nothing and tell them to put it in writing. Personal details. Don't confirm details with a cold caller. If they're genuine, they should have them already. One example is don't be tricked into giving your age. And I heard recently during a talk of this tactic, which was where the caller said, "Oh, you sound just like my mum. How old are you?" "Ooh, exactly the same age as my mum. What month are you born in?" "Ooh, exactly the same month as my mum. But what day of the month?" "Oh no, she was born on the 15th. Well, of course, what you've done there is you've given away your complete date of birth to a scammer. So don't do it. Transferring funds. Banks will never call you to transfer your money to another account if they think your bank security is at risk. Pressure to respond quickly. Scammers will want to push you to rush a decision and not to take time to think the matter through. So take five. Take 5 minutes to think about it if it feels odd. Terminate the call. Say you need time to think about it. Then you can check the details. Talk to a trusted friend or family member. Legitimate companies won't mind, and they'll be happy if you do that. But scammers will talk about deadlines and missed opportunities. Ignore them. Please bear in mind that this information isn't meant to frighten you or stop you going about your normal life, or as much as it's normal as it is at the moment anyway. The information is given so that you are aware of the types of frauds that we know have been happening. Then if somebody tries to scam you, you can think, "Hang on a minute, I've heard about this and I'm not falling for it." But remember, as fast as we get warnings out about scams, the fraudsters will change the story, the trick, the lie. So stay aware and trust your gut instinct. If it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. Take your time, speak to a trusted friend or family member. Or you can contact the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline on 0808 223 1133 and ask for Trading Standards. We will contact you and listen to what's happened, giving you help and support as best we can. To report a scam, contact Action Fraud on 0300 123 2040 and contact your bank if you think you've been tricked into giving financial details. But remember that 5-minute rule, where sometimes the scammers try to keep the line open. Leave it 5 minutes and the line breaks automatically. Or you can ring a friend or family member and check the lines open. Hertfordshire Trading Standards shares regular alerts about scams affecting people in the county. Follow us on Twitter at HCC_TS, T for trading, S for standards, and search for Hertfordshire Trading Standards on Facebook.
And the next item in this series will be in next week's primary programme. Now we have David Ireson, this time talking about what makes English music English.
Hello, it's David Ireson with another half an hour of musical thoughts to entertain you. I don't know whether you are like me, but when I turn the radio on and hear music, I immediately think, do I recognise this piece? And if I don't, then what century does it come from? And perhaps where does it come from? These are difficult questions to answer. I mean, can you immediately tell the difference between Mozart and Haydn, Beethoven or Schubert, or Italian and French Baroque? Can we recognise music from our own country? Is there such a thing as English music, or merely music written by English composers? I know what I mean by English music, but that might not be the same as what others think. Every country has its own traditional music, and in England we can trace it back to medieval times. The Venerable Bede tells us about Caedmon and how the harp was passed around at feasts so that what he called vain and idle songs could be sung. There must have been music for dancing, but none of this was written down, so we know very little about it. Later on, Morris dancers used traditional tunes for their dances, and we know that there were songs about Robin Hood. There's a reference in Piers Plowman. And then we reach a time when courtly music, with paid composers and performers, diverges from folk music. And it seems that only the fiddle or the violin was used by all types of music makers. Folk music was precisely that, music for the ordinary folk, and it reflected their lives, love and melancholy, work and play. We know that there were sea shanties, jigs and hornpipes, for we were a sea-going nation, and songs about the land and the countryside, music for dancing and feasting and general celebration. When we come to the time of the Industrial Revolution, folk music reflected people's lives as being more work-centred and urban rather than agrarian and rural. Technological advances made new instruments available, which gave birth to brass and silver bands. Music from alehouses moved into theatres, and we have music hall, which was very popular. With this change from rural to urban, there was a realisation that the earlier music might disappear, and in the 19th century there was a movement to collect traditional folk songs and write them down before they disappeared entirely. At about the same time, there was a movement in classical music to use country's folk music, and we have a sort of nationalistic phase. Composers like Sibelius, Debussy, Dvorak, Chopin, Brahms, Kodály, and many more. They all wrote music and dances based on the music of their own countries. In England, people like Ralph Vaughan Williams and Cecil Sharp, the founder of the English Folk Dance Society, began to systematically write down the old folk songs from the shires and counties. Vaughan Williams, Gustav Holst, Frederick Delius, Percy Grainger and George Butterworth all incorporated this music into their compositions. Now, certain scenes and pictures can be conjured up with just music. A Parisian cafe, an American nightclub, a Spanish bullfight, a New York street scene, or the English countryside. I do find it amusing that the famous advertisement for a certain loaf of bread had a picture of archetypal England, the famous Shaftesbury Hill, and then used music written by a Czech composer who was writing a symphony from America. But that is by way of our diversion. I expect we could all draw up our own list of English composers from the last 200 years. I'm not including Thomas Tallis and William Byrd, Henry Purcell, who were much earlier. Perhaps our lists would include people like Edward Elgar, Ralph Vaughan Williams, Gustav Holst, Gerald Finzi, George Butterworth, Ivor Gurney, Eric Coates, Malcolm Arnold, Benjamin Britten and Michael Tippett. If I asked you to think of a piece which was typically English, you might come up with Elgar's Nimrod variation from The Enigma, or Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on Greensleeves, or the Thomas Tallis Fantasia, or On Wenlock Edge, George Butterworth's Shropshire Lad, Frederick Delius's Brig Fair, or even God Save the Queen. However, I'd like us to think about pieces which don't have anything specifically English in the title, but seem to me to be very much in the English tradition. I'll mention and play a few pieces which seem to me to be in the English tradition. You may not agree with me, but if it encourages you to think about what English music is, or better still, search out and listen to something which you may not have come across before, then I will be well pleased. How about this? Here's the first couple of minutes of Vaughan Williams's Thomas Tallis Fantasia. Hope it makes you want to hear more of it. He wrote it for the Three Choirs Festival in 1910 and conducted the first performance himself in Gloucester Cathedral. He divides his players into three groups, a full-size string orchestra, a smaller group of nine players, two first violins, two seconds, two violas, two cellos and a double bass, and he asks that this group be placed apart from the main orchestra and a string quartet. The sounds that he conjures from this combination are wonderfully rich and have been described as stained glass beauty, though that might be slightly churchy. Tallis did, after all, write his music for the church. Herbert Howells was then the young organ scholar at Gloucester Cathedral and was both moved and inspired by the first performance, unlike the Gloucester organist who said it was a queer mad work by an odd fellow from Chelsea. It has become one of Vaughan Williams's most loved pieces, together with The Lark Ascending. What is it about this piece, The Lark Ascending, which is English? Why was The Lark Ascending voted the most popular piece on Classic FM for 10 years in a row? Does it say something special to us? Does it say something different to us than it would to the French? I'm not at all sure that I can answer these questions. Anyway, here's something much more obviously English because of the subject material, a well-known English folk song. It's Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on Greensleeves. There are many legends about this song, including the story that it was written by Henry VIII for Anne Boleyn. I'm not sure if I believe that, but it is certainly English and has been around for a few hundred years. Having talked about ceremonial music in the last programme, I am avoiding the more obvious Elgar and Walton examples this time. But Elgar's First Symphony was not written for a ceremonial occasion, but is certainly English in flavour. Just the first 45 seconds will show you what I mean. This tune is definitely not Russian or French, Italian or Spanish. I wonder if you agree with me that it sounds English. The rest of the symphony, however, is another matter. There is a passage at the start of the second movement which reminds me of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet ballet music. Here's a little bit of it. George Butterworth is not a well-known name among composers, perhaps not as well-known as that of the poet A.E. Housman, who wrote A Shropshire Lad. Butterworth set some of these poems to music and also wrote an orchestral idyll, which he called The Banks of Green Willow. Butterworth was great friends with Vaughan Williams and accompanied him on some of his folk song searches. He was also instrumental, no pun intended, in persuading Vaughan Williams to write his first symphony. A promising life in music was cruelly cut short by the First World War, as after being awarded the MC, Butterworth died in the Battle of the Somme. Here is the start of The Banks of Green Willow, which I think you'll agree comes into the nostalgia for the English countryside category, with its obvious links with folk tunes. It's a lovely piece, and if you want to hear all of it, it only lasts 6 or 7 minutes. Now I'd like to turn to another English composer with a distinctive voice, Gerald Finzi. He was, I suppose, what would be called a miniaturist. He didn't write big-scale works like symphonies or operas, but concentrated on songs and chamber music, rather more intimate pieces. He also wrote some wonderful church music too, but since we're concentrating on secular music, let's listen to a bit of the clarinet concerto. Here's the orchestral introduction and the clarinet's first entry. I think Finzi must have been particularly fond of the clarinet. Nearly all young clarinetists will have come across his 5 bagatelles, which are lovely simple pieces. I greatly enjoyed playing them with my son when he was learning the clarinet. I suppose that there is a pastoral element to what I'm talking about, the sort of England that we think of when we are deprived of it. What is it about our country that you particularly like and would miss if it wasn't there? For me, it's the countryside. The weather, strange as that may sound, but it's the variety that I like. The history, and of course, the music. Perhaps you may prefer the bustle of city life. What about this? Elgar, Cocaine Overture, subtitled In London Town, and definitely not pastoral. After his success in 1899 with the Enigma Variations and the initial failure of The Dream of Gerontius, owing to insufficient rehearsal time more than anything else, Elgar went into a rather dispirited phase until the Royal Philharmonic Society commissioned him to write a concert overture, which he called Cocaine, in London Town, and which he dedicated to many friends, the members of British orchestras. And he himself conducted the first performance in the Queen's Hall in London in June 1901. It was an immediate success. Elgar had described it as cheerful and Londony, stout and stakey, honest, healthy, humorous and strong, but not vulgar. I think it qualifies as being in the English tradition, though very different from some of the pastoral and nostalgic music we've heard so far. So here's the start of Elgar's concert overture, Cocaine. Just in case you think I'm being nostalgic and only choosing music of the past, I'd like to finish with a more modern piece by Michael Tippett, I think one of his most approachable, the Concerto for Double String Orchestra. This also isn't exactly pastoral or nostalgic, but full of life and energy, and to me is right in the tradition of English writing. It's interesting that he, like Vaughan Williams before him, decided to use multiple strings. The concerto is miles away from the Talis Fantasia. I love Tippett's rhythmic energy and inventiveness. Here's the start of the Concerto for Double String Orchestra. Thank you. I hope you've enjoyed at least some of this lovely music, and if I've encouraged you to listen to more of the music of the composers I've mentioned, then I'll be delighted. There's so much available to us now that it's very easy to sample things, and if you find some English music that you like and hadn't previously heard, then my efforts will be well worthwhile. Thank you very much for listening.
Now here's a piece written and recorded by local broadcaster and former sportsman Tom McNabb, who talks about his heroes, especially the sporting ones.
I have four sporting heroes, or rather I should say three heroes and one heroine. All of my heroes are people who have acted as catalysts in my sporting life, people who have either changed what I have done in sport, or more importantly, the way I have thought and felt about it. So let's start with my heroine, the German film director, Leni Riefenstahl. In the spring of 1953, driven on by two earlier heroes, but more of them in a moment, I was a nationally ranked triple jumper, and I was now in the RAF on national service, and was at RAF Uxbridge on a fighter command athletics training course. On the first day, halfway through the warm-up, the heavens opened, and we were rushed into a dark, leaky Nissen hut, sat down, and behind us, a film projector started to whir. Great, I thought. Time for a good snooze. But no. What appeared milky and scratched on the tiny screen was Leni Riefenstahl's film of the 1936 Olympics. The opening sequence went back to the broken ruins of Olympia, and from there the film gradually took momentum, flowing into images of naked athletes, culminating in the lone figure of a torchbearer poised, ready to take the Olympic flame on the first stage to the stadium in Berlin. And by the time, a few moments later, the image of the lone runner striding in the dusk through Aegean waves appeared, my eyes were wet with tears. And by the time, over 2 hours later, that the last runner had struggled through the tape in the marathon sequence, Leni Riefenstahl had enslaved me, because she saw the athlete both in success and failure as a hero. A hero because simply in achieving, he drove himself to the edge of his being. And from that day on, I saw athletics, and indeed sport, in an entirely different way.
The Olympic Games have begun. The best athletes in the world have come to Berlin, and 51 nations are represented here today.
I migliori atleti di 51 nazioni vi sono convenuti per disputarsi.
So Riefenstahl became a hero to me, and since then I have seen her 1936 Olympic film hundreds of times. I'm close to speaking terms with people in the crowd, and it has never ceased to move me. And the film took me to my next hero, the great American sprinter, Jesse Owens.
And now for the final. The six fastest sprinters of the world are getting ready. Borschmeier, Germany. Wyckoff, America. Owens. Strandberg of Sweden. Ozendorf of Holland. And Metcalf of America.
Riefenstahl's cameras dwelt lovingly on the supple power and sinuosity of Jesse Owens' movements. At the Berlin Olympics, he made his way not only into Olympic history, but also deep into my imagination.
Owens is ahead. Strandberg and Borschmeier fighting. Ozendorf challenges Wyckoff. Metcalf comes up, but Owens wins in 10.3. Second, Metcalf America. Third, Ozendorf Holland.
I can still see Owens flowing crisply along the Berlin track, the other athletes wallowing in his wake. It's in my memory like a frozen flower. But how did Owens himself see that experience?
Well, I think of the tremendous crowds. I think of the thing that I had wanted to do more than anything else in the world, and that was to be able to win the 100 meters in the Olympic Games. It was a dream and desire of mine for 8 years. I remember when I was in junior high school, and one of our great sprinters of our times by the name of Charlie Paddock came to our school, and I was a seventh grader, and Charlie Paddock became an idol of mine, and then I began to read about the Olympic Games, and then I remember when I was a junior in high school, I was defeated in making the American Olympic team in 1932. And then I looked forward to 36, and my year came, and the one race that I wanted to win most, of course, was the 100 meters, and it was my good fortune to do so. Well, you think in terms of the years of hard work, and then you look at the crowd, and you hear the cheers of the crowd, and you hear your national anthem of your country, and you see your flag rising atop this flagpole, and then you can say to yourself as you receive the gold medal, today I'm an Olympic champion.
So even heroes have heroes. And many years later, Owens was to meet and inspire a 10-year-old child called Carl Lewis. A quick postscript to this story. Many years later, after the war, Jesse Owens was employed by the United States as a sort of roving ambassador. Thus, in the early 1950s, he turned up in Singapore, and a friend of mine, Sergeant Sid Coleman of the Army School of Physical Training, was given the responsibility of taking care of the great man. And when, at the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, I came upon Jesse Owens high in the stands of the Olympic Stadium, surrounded by autograph hunters, all I could think to say was, Sid Coleman sends his regards. And Jesse Owens looked up at me and said, Heck, you know Sid Coleman. Now back to that inspired child. My first sporting hero was 148 years old. It was wartime 1943, and my hero was William Wilson, born in the year of our Lord 1795, and he featured in the pages of a comic paper called The Wizard. William Wilson was the original seven-stone weakling. Weary of the bullying of his schoolmates, he took himself off to Staling Moor in Yorkshire to toughen himself up. There, the young William survived on a diet of nuts and berries and exercised himself by chasing bewildered hares around the moor. This, combined with daily attempts at lifting rocks, made Wilson immensely fit and strong, and he was soon able to deal with the local bullies. But more important than that, Wilson had come upon Matthew, a hermit, close on 200 years of age. For Matthew had come upon the elixir of life, and before he died, when the roof of his cave fell in, he confided the recipe of the elixir to the young Wilson. Now in his late teens, Wilson was an athletic force to be reckoned with. In the first quarter of the 19th century, he had broken 4 minutes for the mile, and had run 100 yards in 9 seconds, and had jumped 7 feet in the high jump, carrying a 16-pound shot, mainly for balance. Upon such tales as these, my young imagination feasted. For though nominally a man, Wilson was essentially a little boy. But unlike most little boys, he was one bristling with strength and authority, one devoid of parents, relatives, and teachers, a little boy totally in control of his life. He was a mixture of Lawrence of Arabia, Sherlock Holmes, and Hercules. Now, the great practical value of heroes is that they excite others to emulate them. Thus, I and my friends set about running round the block in endless races, jumping over improvised high jump stands, and even pole vaulting with my mother's clothes pole. So, Wilson triggered off a spark in me, not just to be an athlete, but to be athletic. And the flame still burns bright all these years on. And it was another children's book that brought me late in 1977 to my next hero, the Scottish runner Eric Liddell, and brought to my door the bulky figure of Colin Welland.
Well, David Putnam rang me up and said that he'd read in a children's book of the history of the Olympic Games about these two men, particularly Liddell, refusing to run on a Sunday and relinquishing his opportunity to win an Olympic 100 metres gold medal because of his religious beliefs. And he said, would you like to come over and discuss the possibility of there being a screenplay in it? So I went over to his house, and he had the scrapbook, the 3A's scrapbook of the 1924 Olympic Games. And just leafing through those pages at all the young men of the period with their straw hats and their blazers and the Victorian patriarchs in their big sort of silent movie beards and the long shorts and the girls in their cloche hats, and just sort of that caught my imagination to start with. But when I started to research into the men themselves, they were such compelling characters that had largely been forgotten, that I thought, this is a tale to tell.
And what a tale it turned out to be. My job initially was a script consultant to Colin Welland. Later, on meeting David Putnam, I found to my surprise that I also had to choose the actors to play their leading roles in the athletic parts, including that of the missionary Eric Liddell, whose running style we had to try to reproduce.
His running was great probably till he came to the last 200 yards where really he had to put in an effort. And then the head went back, and the elbows came up. But when that happened, the rest of the race could pretty well say, we may as well give up. I asked him how he did it. And in his own words, he said, well, when the gun goes, I go as fast as I can. And I trust to God I'll have the strength to do the second half.
The film and its four Oscars is now history. But years later, I met a gentleman called Norman Cliff, who had, as a boy, been with Eric Liddell in the internment camp in China, in which Liddell had died in 1943. One story of Cliff's summarised better than any other the nature of the muscular Christian that Eric Liddell was. Back in 1924, Liddell had, for religious reasons, refused to run on the Sabbath.
Some of the papers were very much against him and criticised him. He got a lot of criticism. In fact, he got quite a lot of pressure on him. However, he stuck to his principles.
He just accepted these things, and I never remember him being upset. He said, it's just my belief. I don't criticise others about it, but I'm not going to run on this on the Sunday.
But Norman Cliff told me that on one occasion, the children of the camp had asked Liddell if they could play football on a Sunday. And Liddell, swallowing his reservations, had agreed, suffer ye the little children to come unto me. Children. For heroes, whatever other purposes they may serve, serve the purpose of driving others to emulate them. And their influence upon children especially can never be underestimated. But heroes need distance, and maybe I was lucky, for that necessary distance has vanished in a world of chat shows and tabloid newspapers. It's not that our heroes turn out to have feet of clay. Sometimes they turn out to have brains and bodies of clay as well. I suppose that one way and the other, I have met all my living heroes. But what about Wilson? Well, I met him in my imagination half a century ago. And I suppose he gave me the elixir of life in a pleasure in physical activity, which, if it hasn't put years in my life, has certainly put life in my years. Yes, Wilson of the Wizard still lives on in me now, striding effortlessly, like Riefenstahl's Olympic torchbearers, through the green fields of my imagination. To me, they're all heroes, all sportsmen and women who dig deep into muscle and will to achieve their dreams. For the athlete always runs against a shadow, against the man he was yesterday. He is a modern man who has decided to burst the walls of his prison.
Now we have our piece of music, Running Water's Full by Gothby, in its entirety. And finally, here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 2nd of August 1932, Peter O'Toole, stage, film and television actor, was born, possibly in Leeds or possibly in Ireland. He always said he wasn't sure. His first starring role was T. Lawrence in the 1962 film Lawrence of Arabia. On the 3rd of August 1811, Elisha Otis was born in Halifax, Vermont, USA. He invented a lift with a safety locking mechanism. In 1853, at the New York World's Fair, he gained publicity when he ordered the only rope holding the platform on which he was standing to be cut by an axe man, and the platform fell only a few inches before coming to a halt. On the 4th of August, 1901, Louis Armstrong, trumpeter, composer, and vocalist who was among the most influential figures in jazz. He was born in New Orleans in USA. On the 5th of August, 1930, Neil Armstrong, naval aviator, test pilot, astronaut, and the first man to walk on the moon, was born in Ohio, USA. In 1983, Armstrong was part of an expedition to the North Pole and said that he was curious to see what it looked like from the ground, as he had only seen it from the moon. On the 6th of August, 1881, Alexander Fleming, the bacteriologist who discovered penicillin in 1928, was born in Ayrshire in Scotland. On the 7th of August, 1876, Margareta Zeller, an exotic dancer and courtesan who is better known by a stage name Marta Hari, was born in Leeuwarden in the Netherlands. In 1917, she was accused of being a German spy, arrested, tried, and executed by firing squad. Incidentally, Marta Hari is the Malay word for the sun, literally meaning the eye of the day. On the 8th of August 1937, actor Dustin Hoffman was born in Los Angeles, USA. He has had an outstanding career as a film actor, starting with The Graduate in 1967. And now some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 2nd of August 1870, the world's first underground railway in a bored tunnel began operating when the Tower Subway beneath the River Thames in central London was opened. A narrow-gauge railway was laid in the tunnel, and a cable-hauled wooden carriage conveyed passengers from one end to the other. Sadly, it was a complete failure, and the company went bankrupt by the end of the year. The tunnel is actually still in use today, carrying water mains and telecommunications cables under the Thames. On the 3rd of August 1805, the first Eton versus Harrow cricket match took place on the original Lord's ground. Lord Byron, a Harrovian, is thought to have been one of the schoolboys involved in the issue of the challenge to Eton. The match continues to be played each year at Lord's. On the 4th of August 1944, Anne Frank and her family were captured by the Germans in Amsterdam, after being in hiding in an attic for 25 months. I just can't imagine what it must have been like to be stuck in an attic, trying to be quiet, for more than 2 years. Extraordinary. On the 5th of August, 1888, Bertha Benz made the first ever long-distance car journey. Bertha was the wife and business partner of the car's inventor, Carl Benz. She drove her two sons from Mannheim to Pforzheim in Germany, a distance of about 66 miles. It was an epic trip, lasting from dawn till dusk, and she overcame several technical difficulties on the way. She only informed her husband of the trip by telegram when she arrived in Pforzheim. She said afterwards that her purpose was to visit her mother, but in reality she did it to publicise the car, which her husband had previously made no attempt to do. In this she succeeded enormously, as the trip drew great attention. Clearly she was a very resourceful woman, and equally clearly the business brains of the partnership. On the 6th of August 1926, 20-year-old American Olympic swimmer Gertrude Edderley became the first woman to swim across the English Channel. Previously, only 5 men had made the crossing, and the best time had been 16 hours 33 minutes. Gertrude walked up the beach at Kingsdown near Dover after 14 hours and 34 minutes, only to be met by a British immigration officer requesting her passport. When she returned home, she was given a ticker tape parade in New York, and more than 2 million people turned out to cheer her. She died in 2003 at the age of 98. On the 7th of August 1993, Buckingham Palace was opened to tourists for the first time, mainly to help pay for the repairs to Windsor Castle after the major fire that had occurred there in November 1992. On the 8th of August 1969, photographer Ian McMillan took the iconic photograph of the Beatles crossing Abbey Road at a zebra crossing. A policeman was hired to stop the traffic for 5 minutes, while McMillan took his photos from a stepladder. The zebra crossing was given Grade 2 listed status in 2010. A few years ago, I took a photo of my wife on that very zebra crossing, although sadly none of the Beatles were there then. And on that note, we finish this programme. Many thanks to Wendy, Jenny, Jilly and Ian for reading today, to Angela who provided the radio listings, and to John who read them, and to Mark who makes all the copies of the programme and ensures you get yours. And of course, we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra for July 2020. Goodbye.